From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
An illegal, brutal regime that gains international recognition and credibility, from the international community is a detriment to the entire world. In fact, it's against everything that the United Nations stands for. And that's why we must unseat the military regime of Burma, and we must make a clear stand. As in the case of South Africa, the international community must make a stand.
Today, as world leaders gather at the United Nations, we'll look at the effort to unseat Burma. Then an update on the case of Lori Berenson, who's been moved from her prison in Arequipa, Peru, to Lima. Her parents are trying to slow down the juggernaut to a civilian trial. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. All the world's problems will be put on the table for discussion at the UN Millennium Summit, which is running through Friday as more than 150 kings, presidents, and prime ministers arrive in New York. The session, from Wednesday to Friday, is billed as the largest ever gathering of world leaders, even bigger than the world body's 50th anniversary celebrations 5 years ago, which drew some 118 heads of state and government. And this news from Illinois: George W. Bush, who promised to bring a new tone of civility to politics, got himself in trouble when a whispered expletive about a New York Times reporter was caught on a live mic. Later, the Republican presidential nominee said he regretted that everyone had heard his comment, but sidestepped a question about whether he would apologize to the journalist. The Texas governor was unaware his microphone was live when he leaned over to his running mate, Dick Cheney, at a Labor Day rally and said, "There's Adam Clymer, major league asshole from the New York Times." Cheney replied, "Oh yeah, he is, big time." Bush was unhappy with a series of articles Clymer critical of his record as governor. Texas Governor George W. Bush derided Vice President Al Gore for rejecting his debate proposal this weekend. The ABC and CBS television networks, which were left out of Governor George W. Bush's presidential debates proposal, said they have no intention of carrying debates sponsored by rival networks like NBC and CNN. The Bush proposal, announced on Sunday after negotiations with officials of six cable and broadcast networks, has thrown into turmoil the work of the Commission on Presidential Debates, the panel created in 1987 by Democrats and Republicans to preserve the two-party system. Since the creation of the panel, no candidate has gone so far to circumvent its work. The panel's executive director said she still hopes to negotiate an agreement under which Bush will consent to the commission's schedule. China is demanding that the United States block a lawsuit against Li Peng. China denounced the civil lawsuit filed against the former Chinese premier over the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre and demanded Washington throw out the case. The foreign ministry spokesperson said this is a political farce fabricated by a small handful of anti-China elements in the United States out of despicable motives. Last week, the former Chinese premier was served with a lawsuit charging him with crimes against humanity. Actually, it was State Department security that was served at about 6 in the morning. Amnesty International published a report today stating that the Palestinian Authority routinely arrests those who oppose its policies, creating an atmosphere hostile to free expression. The Palestinian Authority describing it an established pattern in a 15-page report. The London-based human rights watchdog group said the authority has detained dozens of human rights defenders, journalists, religious figures, writers, government officials, trade unionists, and academics solely for exercising their legitimate rights to freedom of expression. Amnesty said it had chronicled 13 cases of prisoners of conscience in the last year alone. Many are detained without charges for weeks or even months, it that said some reported being tortured. And fighting gripped Sri Lanka for a second day, leaving at least 344 people dead as the military mounted a major offensive ahead of crucial parliamentary polls. The Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam launched two attacks against military positions in the northern peninsula of Jaffna, but according to government officials in Sri Lanka, were repulsed. And Burma went on the offensive today against its critics over the latest crackdown on pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, saying foreigners are meddling in its affairs and instigating unrest. We'll have more on that story later in the program. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Last week, we reported the news from Peru that the Peruvian regime has now admitted that Lori Berenson, the American who has been imprisoned in Peru for almost 5 years now, sentenced to life in prison for treason against the fatherland. The Peruvian government admitted that she was not a leader of the rebel group MRTA. She has been imprisoned there at the Socabaya prison over the last few years in the second largest city of Peru, Arequipa, and over the weekend was moved to Lima, to a women's maximum security prison there. We're joined by Lori's father, Mark Berenson, who is a statistician based in New York. Her mother is in Lima, Peru right now with her lawyer, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, dealing with all of the latest developments, which seem to be moving this juggernaut towards a civilian trial with the military tribunal voiding her life sentence. Mark Berenson, can you tell us the latest news we have reported as of last week that this trial, the military tribunal had voided her life sentence?
Yes, good morning. And as you reported, we're very pleased. That was a major step that Peru, after all these years, acknowledged what Lori has said all along, that she wasn't a leader and is not a member of the MRTA. This is a major admission, but it undermines all its claims against Lori. And from the moment of Lori's arrest back in November 95, she always said she was innocent of the preposterous charges against her, and she was not even a member, let alone a leader, nor was she involved in any of its plans. So this important admission really requires dismissal not only of all the charges in the military courts, which they did, but they should be sending her home. There's no reason that they should be looking now to double jeopardize her and charge her with the same things without the title of leadership. They never have evidence before. There's no way they're going to get evidence made up now unless they take it from the crypts. And I'm saying that literally and figuratively because the newspapers in Peru, which are as accurate as a broken wristwatch, they're right one time in every 12 in Lori's case, are claiming that they're looking, found new evidence from dead bodies who spoke during the Japanese ambassador's residence hostage crisis. And they're saying that they have this new evidence that Lori was involved. And, you know, dead men don't wear plaid and dead men don't talk. So anyway, that's the latest mishigas coming from Peru. And we don't know. Ramsey, Clark and Roeder are looking today at the process. The Peruvian government has never put in writing what it is that the limitations, the constraints, the parameters The Peruvian papers report the process, but again, if there
meaning
is
meaning a civilian trial,
for a civilian trial, and they're doing this at a pace that will break a 4-minute mile. I mean, Lori was just moved to Lima on Thursday. The judge was waiting for her when she arrived to question her. She said, "Listen, I'm an American citizen named Lori Berenson. I will not speak to you unless I speak to the U.S. government, the United States Embassy, my parents, and their legal representatives. I have no idea what's going on. I've been in solitary, essentially, and not aware of what's happening. And I'm not speaking until then." So the judge last Thursday and said, "Okay, Lori, you've got till Wednesday at 10 o'clock.
So the judge was waiting at the prison to interrogate her?
Yes.
The new civilian judge?
Yes, yes. Rommel, his name is. Rommel Borda. Rommel was bare ready, and Lori just said, "Hey, this is absurd." The U.S. Embassy was trying to get in with over 200 photographers blocking the gates. It took them over a half hour to get through the crowd and enter. So Lori said that, and Lori will say the same thing tomorrow if Rommel and company come, because if the world is watching what kind of trial this is going to be, we're talking a real show trial here. It makes Iran and Russia look like they've got company in South America. And if this is going to happen, then clearly Lori needs time to rehearse and for her show. And
her show, what do you mean?
Well, there's going to be a show trial because there is no evidence against her, and the Peruvians are going to fabricate people to stand up as movie actors or TV actors to say things against her, and it's going to be their word against Lori's plus the words of dead people.
Mark Berenson, let's stop for a minute, because there was really explosive news released over the weekend about how it is that the military tribunal voided her life sentence. It's something you've known about for quite a while, but it has been kept secret from the public. On what grounds, what, quote, new information did they have that indicated to them that Lori was not a leader of the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, the MRTA?
Well, information came about to four people of very high rank in Peruvian politics and Latin American politics during the hostage crisis. And it was clear at that time that Lori was not the monster Peru was creating and continued to create. And therefore, the Peruvian government approached us over a year ago to tell us, to admit to the United States that, you know, we've badmouthed Lori Berenson, but, you know, we know she wasn't a leader, she wasn't a member, she wasn't an active participant, and that this has got to be resolved. They're talking about a year ago. Lori Berenson filed her petition, called in Spanish Recurso de Revisión, on the 20th of November, 1999, is when she signed the typed document. The U.S. Embassy submitted this on Lori's behalf on December 6th, 1999, and it was accepted and stamped in on December 7th, 1999, as reported in Peruvian papers this week. So that's how long ago this case has been going on, following the admission of the Peruvian government to us and to the United States government about that Lori isn't this monster. Nevertheless, the Peruvians during the elections played up Lori with demagoguery and made her such a monster in Peru. They called her in the papers the Gringer Assassinina, the Assassinina terrorist, the murderous terrorist. And if this is after, and the Peruvian government did that knowing she wasn't, and admitting that she wasn't,
how
getting
did
away
they
with
know
it for its election.
How purposes. Did they know that she wasn't?
Well, if based on the testimony that was provided, they knew that Lori was not involved in any of the work of the MRTA.
Who were the people within the Peruvian government?
Well, the names of the people that appear in her petition, since we thought this was so secure that instead of Lori hiring a Peruvian lawyer to get the information, in our meetings with the military Supreme Court, they realized that national security was potentially involved, and they allowed Lori to fill this out pro se, meaning on her own. She filed a petition, given that she became aware of evidence from the Peruvian government that four people were willing to come forth and provide testimony to the effect she wasn't a leader, because it was the leadership that gave her the secret military tribunal and condemned her for treason.
That was on the grounds of her being a leader. That's why she went before this hooded military tribunal,
right,
and ultimately, with a gun to her head, had her sentence read out to her, which was life in prison,
right,
served at the Anamayo prison high in the Andes, and then at Socabaya, now in Lima. Who were these four people?
Okay, this is a quote from paragraph 4, the English translation of her recurso. What she says is, I was convicted of acting in the capacity of a leader, head chief, or other equivalent of the MRTA as stated in Article 2 of a particular Peruvian law. During my entire judicial proceeding, I consistently maintained that I was never a leader, head chief, or other equivalent, and do not believe it was ever proved that I acted as a leader, head chief, or other equivalent of the MRTA. Because I was not a leader, head chief, or other equivalent, my conviction is not valid, and the charges against me must be dismissed. I therefore present this recurso de revisión as a petition, because new evidence has become available which will show that I was not a leader, head chief, or other equivalent. The four witnesses who have this information are...
And this is the new news, folks.
Yes. Dr. Jorge Valdez Corillo, at the time Vice Minister of Foreign Relations in Peru, now the United Nations Permanent Representative or UN Ambassador of Peru to the United Nations, located in New York City.
Again, his name.
Dr. Jorge Valdez Corillo, C-A-R-R-I-L-L-O.
So the U.N. ambassador from Peru says that he knows, he has information that she is not. Who are the other three?
Okay. And at the time, he was Vice Minister of Foreign Relations. Second on the list, well, I'll do them in the, because three of them assigned the affidavits. Admiral Luis Giampietre Rojas, President of the Peruvian Institute of the Sea, which goes under the acronym IMARPE. So it's a non-governmental agency. He's the president of the Peruvian Institute of the Sea, but he used to be the highest-ranking admiral of the Peruvian Navy, now retired. And he has evidence of this. The third person is the Honorable Jorge Gumucio Granier. Jorge Gumucio Graña, ambassador of Bolivia to Peru. So a foreign dignitary.
Again, his title?
He was the ambassador from the country Bolivia to the government of Peru.
Uh-huh.
So he had a foreigner there.
Uh-huh.
These three men did sign in testimony in Lori's case that she was not a leader.
Okay, now why were they in a position to know? Who were hostages at the Japanese ambassador's residence, which was taken over by the MRTA?
Yeah, the MRTA took about 600 hostages on the night of Tuesday, the 17th of December, 1996, at a party for the Emperor of Japan held at the Japanese ambassador's residence. In the first hours, they freed every woman, every child, and every elderly man. And then they...
Lori was in prison at this time.
Lori was prisoned 500 miles away in southern Peru for a year when this happened. The MRTA at the time announced that they were doing this because of horrendous prison conditions in Peru, which are true, and that they wanted the release of members of the MRTA and those like Lori who were falsely accused of being members of the MRTA. At the end, 4 months later, there were 72 hostages left, including the men that I've just mentioned. And these people live to tell the tales of what went on during those 126 days. But every member of the MRTA, the 14 members of the Edgardo Sanchez commando, were killed or assassinated. Some of them surrendered and were assassinated.
The MRTA were all executed by the Peruvian military when they stormed the residence.
Yes. And four of those people came forward last year to tell the government, hey, you're doing, the story on Lori is nuts. And the fourth person is Francisco Tudela, currently the vice president of Peru under President Fujimori. At the time he said that he would provide information, he was the United Nations ambassador to Peru. At the time of the hostage crisis...
He was the Peruvian ambassador to the United Nations.
And he was, at the hostage crisis, the foreign minister of Peru, and they threatened to kill him the first day, and of course they didn't, but he was wounded during the siege that saved all of the hostages.
So the current vice president of Peru has known all through this period that Lori Berenson was not a leader of the MRTA, And yet through this year, Fujimori continually talked about her as such. In fact, she became an issue in the, if you can call it, the presidential campaign, both sides, the opposition candidate, as well as Fujimori, who reiterated that she was a leading terrorist in the world today. Mark Berenson, if you could hang on with us, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. And when we're done with Lori Berenson's father, Mark Berenson, Lori Berenson, now having her life sentence voided in Peru and faces a civilian trial. We're going to be talking about what's happening this week at the United Nations, the largest gathering of world leaders in history. At the same time, there are all sorts of protests going on at the United Nations, and there's an effort that is underway to unseat the government of Burma, saying it is illegitimate, and we'll be joined by people involved in that struggle. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We are talking to Mark Berenson, giving us the latest on Lori Berenson's case. Lori Berenson, the American who was charged with being a leader of the rebel group MRTA in Peru, has been in prison now for almost 5 years, first at the prison Yanamayo, which is infamous high in the Andes, and then moved down to the Socabaya prison in Arequipa, now has been moved to Lima. Before we go on with the significance of these men coming forward and Fujimori knowing all this period, though continually holding up her passport and saying she is a leading terrorist in Peru, what was her trip like from Socabaya to Lima on Thursday, Mark Berenson?
Well, I understand she went with a military escort surrounded by large numbers of soldiers and vans and ambulance screaming, with sirens blaring, and yet she was escorted with dignity, walking. She saw mountains for the first time, houses, people, buildings, trees. Where she's been, she can only see the sky. The height of the walls and the prisons she's been in prevented her from seeing anything but sky. And for the first time, she saw children and people. And I would love to ask her what it was like. And on the plane, she was joking with some of the soldiers. And I did ask Rhoda to ask her if a flight attendant offered her their famous basket of a picnic lunch with drink. And Rhoda said, Lori said, yes, they did offer that.
So she wasn't blindfolded.
No, and they talked. And in fact, a high-ranking soldier in the military police, a PNP, said that, Lori, what your parents are doing, what you're doing is wonderful for Peru. They really must correct the injustices in the prison system and make this a more humane place. And Lori was very excited to hear that said by a high-ranking soldier in the military police, the PNP. And, I mean, there is hope that when you have people, decent people like that, saying that there is hope for Peru in the future. And there's good and bad in every organization and, you know, in every way of life, but Lori was uplifted by that remark and told it to Rhoda, who related it to me, so I can relate it to you.
Now, does Rhoda and you, do the family, have access to Lori in the Trujillo's prison where she is now?
No, they don't. Laurie is being seen this morning by Ramsey Clark and Roeder, I believe, or maybe by one of them, in order to move forward on what her legal proceedings for prepare her for a potential visit tomorrow by the judge again. But she, we don't have access to her regularly, which is wrong, because how can anybody prepare anything? They're ramroding this thing through. We don't have a lawyer. In fact, we don't know whether we should even legitimize an illegitimate process. The whole world has condemned the justice system in Peru, saying that even their civilian courts are incapable of providing international standards worth of fairness, openness, and due process. And our State Department, for once, made the statement that they think Peru did a good first step, but they don't believe Peru has the infrastructure to provide a fair trial under these conditions.
If they forced her to move forward and the judge is saying he will begin the process tomorrow, what will you do? You don't even have a Peruvian lawyer at this point.
No, the newspapers today suggest that the judge will appoint a public defender for Laurie if we're not ready. But Laurie's last words to Roeder on Monday is that she was wondering whether she should say something at all to perpetuate the farce, or whether she should just defend herself or just say nothing. So we don't know what our strategy is going to be, and I know Roeder and Ramsey have been speaking to potential people to learn about the system.
Ramsey Clark being the former Attorney General of the United States under Lyndon Johnson, who is her legal advisor and in Lima right now with her mother, Rhoda Berenson. Now, what about Fujimori during the last presidential campaign where he took office? Can't even call it a campaign with the opposition. Toledo pulling out, saying it was illegitimate. Toledo, when he came to the United States, said that Laurie Berenson's case should be reviewed.
Yeah. Toledo was in New York in April at a Foreign Relations Council meeting, and when questioned by Reuters, he said Laurie's case is flawed, full of flaws of due process, and that other things that he's heard about it requires a total review of her case, and even he would interview her. By the time he went from New York to Washington, Fujimori's people picked up on that in Lima and started screaming how soft Toledo was on terrorism. So Mr. Toledo, who has is known to flop up and down like a yo-yo or roller coaster, by the time he got south and being afraid of being called soft on terrorism, he tried to show how macho he was. As Laurie Berenson will never be freed, terrorism holds no national boundaries, I will never let the courts review her case if I'm president. And in his next line, of course, Toledo said, well, when I'm president, we're going to have a completely independent judiciary system. So that was the opposition candidate, folks, Alejandro Toledo.
And this at the time, Fujimori was slamming him, knew that Laurie Berenson was not a leader of the MRTA. In fact, in the World Almanac of Peru,
The World Almanac, which you can buy here in New York, I believe, it's published on 3rd Avenue somewhere, but I've seen it in the United States and in Peru. It lists, under the 1990s decade, terrorism, and it just talks about two people, Abimael Guzman, the president of leader of the Shining Path, and Laurie Berenson, the famous Gringa terrorista. In one case, Mr. Guzman legitimately is known for his work in Peru. In the other case, the story is totally fabricated, that of Laurie. Dirty tricks, the same tricks that were used by Fujimori to defeat Mr. Toledo and his other opposition this year, Mayor Andrade and former Minister Castaneda Lloso, and used against the journalist Baruch Ifker to make up stories that they can't fight back on, have been used for 5 years against Laurie. And when the Peruvian government knew and had already told us and the United States government that Laurie was not this monster, they created an even greater monster out of Laurie during the campaign when they used government funds to publish flyers that were distributed in northern Peru in the city of Piura, which said, if you vote for Toledo, you're voting for the freedom of that killer terrorist Laurie Berenson. That was the first bulleted point. The demagoguery, the scary, when they knew that Laurie wasn't this monster. So the problem was we didn't know when the military courts would finally act on Laurie's case. It was submitted last year. We had hopes it would be done by Christmas, which is a period of amnesty in Peru, a New Year's for the Catholic holiday, Jubilation 2000. If you recall, on January 11th last year, to celebrate, if you will, the fourth anniversary of Laurie's life sentencing, she went on a two-week hunger strike. And the reason she did it was that she was disgusted with the lack of justice, because she knew about what was going on and it wasn't moving. And so she was annoyed at both the Peruvian government for sitting and for the U.S. government for not forcing it. And she made that statement. So now this all ties in as to why she went on that hunger strike January 11th, because she was hoping and waiting for her case to move last year. And then when it didn't, it became obvious that the Peruvian military Supreme Court was going to do this at its own pace, or whatever pace it was told to do it at. You can interpret my meaning of that. It was going to do it at its own pace, or whatever pace it was told to do it at, and that it just sat there and sat there and sat there, and we were expecting movement on this, as I said, really, any time from Christmas, and it finally happened, thank God, last week. But it finally happened, and Peru has now publicly admitted what we've known for over a year, what the U.S. government has known for a year, what many members of Congress have known because the Peruvians have told them that.
In fact, right now, the U.S. Congress, more than half of Congress members have signed a petition?
Yes, we have 250 members of the current Congress, which is current House of Representatives, which is 57%, saying Lori must be released. That's they either signed petitions or they voted for an amendment by Maxine Waters, but in this current two-year session of the 106th Congress, 250 out of the 440 members and representatives, 57%, and in the Senate, 43 senators, or 43%, have signed petitions urging Lori's release. And that's a big message to Peru, because the Congress controls the purse strings, and Peru is clearly very afraid of losing their life support, which is aid from the United States.
And today, I understand, New York Congressmember Carolyn Maloney will be holding a news conference calling for Lori Berenson's freedom in New York. That news conference will be held. Mark Berenson, I want to thank you for being with us again. This major news, the naming of the four people who, for the last year, have had information that Lori Berenson was not a leader of the MRTA, including the vice president of Peru, the current sitting vice president of Peru, as well as the UN ambassador from Peru and the leader of, was it the Navy?
The former highest-ranking member of the Navy and also the ambassador from Bolivia. I don't like to say for a second that the vice president didn't sign, probably because he was running to be vice president, and it probably was not a great thing for him to do, and that's why we only had three at the end. Three members submitted their statements, even though we were told initially that there were four, and Lori has named four.
But at this point, the government says a civilian trial will move forward, and in that civilian trial, Lori Berenson could face as many as 20 to 30 years in prison.
I've also heard life.
Mark Berenson, the father of Lori Berenson. If people want to get more information on her case, where can they go?
The website is www.freelori, one eight-letter word, freelori.org.
And again, this week, the judge says the proceedings will commence tomorrow, and we'll bring you the latest news on this. And I should say we will be breaking a major story on Lori Berenson in the days to come. So do tune in to Democracy Now! Mark Berenson, Lori Berenson's father, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Next up, we're going to talk about Burma and the efforts in this Millennium UN Summit that is taking place over these next 3 days to have the Burmese regime unseated at the United Nations. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Burma's foreign minister, Wing Aung, left Rangoon for the United States to attend the UN Millennium Summit this week, which is the largest gathering of world leaders ever. It's taking place at the United Nations from Wednesday to Friday and will be opened by President Clinton. International pressure is increasing on the junta to release Aung San Suu Kyi as the military junta steps up a crackdown on the detained opposition leader. Burmese analysts in Bangkok are warning today that Win Aung will face intense criticism from UN members, including the U.S. and Britain, at the summit for its handling of Aung San Suu Kyi and members of her National League for Democracy, known as the NLD. Already, Amnesty International today called on the Burmese junta to release Aung San Suu Kyi and her party lieutenants who are under house arrest in Rangoon. The rights group said in a statement, "We strongly urge the Burmese government to allow them freedom of movement," referring to Aung San Suu Kyi, saying that the government should immediately reveal the whereabouts of Aung San Suu Kyi and her colleagues who've been held incommunicado, increasing fears for their crackdown for their welfare. In Rangoon, the crackdown on the NLD leadership continued as diplomats from several Western embassies attempted to visit party chiefs, but were rebuffed by the junta's security forces. This is what's happening in Rangoon. In the United States, the Free Burma Coalition is organizing a campaign to unseat Burma at the United Nations this week. And we're joined by a number of people who are involved with that effort. The coalition planning to meet with the UN Credentials Committee, which hears the credentials of representatives of each country to determine if those officials are the legitimate officials of that country. We're joined right now by three people. In the studio with us here in New York is Nisha Anand, who is a field organizer with the War Resisters League from the Free Burma Coalition, herself arrested in Burma, held and then expelled. On the phone with us from Washington, D.C. is Sandy Ong, who is the Burma Project Coordinator of Asia Pacific Center for Justice and Peace. We're also joined by Patrick Bond, who's a professor in Johannesburg, South Africa at Wits University, joining us to talk to us about the same effort that took place more than 20 years ago to have South Africa, apartheid South Africa, decredentialed from the United Nations, and it was decredentialed in 1974. But let's begin with Nisha Anand here in the studio. Talk about what you're going to do to prevent Burma from being ceded.
Currently, the military regime is given a seat at the United Nations. This is an illegal regime who has taken force from the 60s, but after the 1988 uprising and the 90 elections, with brutality, the force, the human rights abuses committed by this regime, and the fact that they annulled the elections of 1990 and have arrested most of the leaders.
Aung San Suu Kyi would have been president.
She was not allowed to run. She was actually arrested before and not allowed to run in the election, but her party, the National League for Democracy, won the majority of the seats. She was herself not allowed to run, but it is her party that won the elections. The fact that that regime is given international credibility by having a seat in the United Nations is ridiculous. It's definitely an affront to the notion of democracy and actually to the to everything that's inside the UN Charter.
Sandy Ong, Burma Project Coordinator of the Asia Pacific Center for Justice and Peace, and you're Burmese yourself. You were in Burma. When was the last time?
I was in Burma in 1996.
Explain how this process will work. How will you approach the Credentials Committee?
Well, we are going to approach the United States as well as Britain and also the Southeast Asian countries to question the junta's legitimacy in representing Burma. So now we are starting with the letter writing to the explaining the situation in Burma. This is a critical situation, and also the junta do not represent Burmese people. Therefore, they should question the credibility at the Credential Committee.
Mm-hmm. And how realistic do you think it is that Burma would be decredentialed?
Well, first of all, this regime right now, this is called SPDC, did not participate in the election. Plus, they took the power by force by cracking down the democracy movement, by cracking down the elected party. Therefore, they do not represent the people of Burma. And the United Nations itself has to ask whether they are representing the group of military or the people of Burma.
Well, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, Patrick Bond will join us to talk about how this effort was led a quarter of a century ago to decredential apartheid South Africa. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Our guest, Sandy Ong, who is the Burma Project Coordinator of Asia Pacific Center for Justice and Peace in Washington, Nisha Anand with the War Resisters League in New York, one of the coordinators of the Free Burma Coalition, and we'll be joined by Professor Patrick Bond in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. World leaders gathering at the United Nations for the largest grouping of world leaders in history, taking place this week, the UN Millennium Summit. Among those who will be there are the leaders of the military junta of Burma. And there is an effort underway to get this regime decredentialed from the United Nations. We're joined by some of those who are leading this effort. Nisha Anand and Sandy Ong are with us. They are with the War Resisters League, Nisha Anand, and the Asia Pacific Center for Justice and Peace, Sandy Ong. And also Professor Patrick Bond, who is Associate Professor of Public Policy at Wits University in Johannesburg. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Patrick Bond. Can you tell us about the efforts in South Africa a quarter of a century ago to get them decredentialed from the UN, which was successful?
Yes, it was indeed an excellent precedent, and thanks for having me back here on your show. I think the precedent transcends activity at the UN. It goes to the whole question of how sanctions can be called by democratic movements who are affected. And in the case of South Africa, the relationship between the internal and external struggles for democracy, like in Burma today, are very important. The African nations at the United Nations were terribly important in the 1960s, raising the issue of the credentials of the South African ambassador to the UN from about 1963, although, as you say, it was only in 1974 that basically overriding the vetoes from the United States, Britain, and France in the Security Council, that the UN General Assembly did what now is going to be asked of the General Assembly in relation to Burma, that is to take a credentials committee to question the legitimacy of the regime, then to go to vote in the General Assembly. In the case of South Africa, the vote was 91-22, but particularly to expect very, very strong leadership from senior UN officials. In 1974, it was the Algerian presiding officer, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who really pushed through, above and beyond what the United States was willing to concede. And even in the 60s, you found that the Burmese general secretary was also very strongly anti-apartheid. And that's now the kind of precedent that Kofi Annan is going to have to look at and decide whether, in a context where U.S. power is much greater, U.S. Sanctions against Burma haven't really begun to kick in. And in fact, the Massachusetts state case, where the Supreme Court has knocked down the Massachusetts effort to do procurement buying prohibitions on companies that do business in South Africa, this all puts a lot more pressure, and it's a very surgical moment for the struggle to move forward.
Patrick Bond, you have an interesting connection, well, not only to South Africa, but to Burma itself, a family connection.
Well, in fact, my grandfather had been a senior colonial official, but it really brought, particularly in the 1980s anti-apartheid struggles, where I learned in the United States as a student, the core message of how to respond to calls for solidarity. It's a very, very important message today, Amy, as many debates are occurring between progressive forces north and south about the kind of sanctions, for example, social clauses on trade and a variety of other questions as to how to punish regimes, what's the most appropriate humanitarian concerns to take forward, and how does one bring them into the economic sphere. I think with South Africa and the southern African countries, Haiti and now Burma, we have such an absolutely unequivocal statement of how a mass democratic force in a third world country is asking folks in the north to ally with them, and any of your listeners should take that on board very, very seriously.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the same configuration of power is in place that was against apartheid South Africa in regards to Burma? Do you think this is realistic, that they will be decredentialed?
I couldn't say, because I think the challenge still lies ahead, with particularly a big march coming up on Friday to really bring to the United Nations General Assembly's attention this issue and the fact that so many people are now watching. But I would say it's a difficult time. I could even illustrate by how the struggle for a free Burma in South Africa, which is led by local South Africans who have numbers of connections, as well as exile folks from Burma in South Africa, they've been trying, and you may know that Nelson Mandela himself has not been unequivocally progressive on this issue, has said to the ASEAN countries, if Burma wants to be part of your Association of Southeast Asian Nations, that's fine. We won't sort of bring the South African concerns of human rights to the fore. And in fact, South Africa, tragically and shamefully, really, has full diplomatic relations with what's called Myanmar, with Burma. And so the Free Burma campaign in South Africa has been struggling so far in a, I think, quite successful way to bring to the South African government's attention the contradictions of a global campaign for human rights, which helped to free South Africa from apartheid, and now South Africa's own relations with the Burmese regime, for example, in breaking travel agent relations and in questioning the role of even a Burmese member of the Burmese junta, the SPDC, at the inauguration last year of President Thabo Mbeki. So these are concerns, and I think the general tenor of global geopolitics is such that South Africa is just trying to make friends, and even with Suharto before he was kicked out of Indonesia, in order to try to bring the non-aligned movement, which it chairs, to bear. That means it's really going to be more and more important for activists themselves in civil society and the humanitarian human rights organizations to move these issues forward, because even the South African government might not be as firm as we would have expected, given that very, very important precedent of using the UN and sanctions to help achieve democracy.
Nisha Anand, you went to Burma a few years ago as part of really a student delegation. You were at American University in Washington. Mm-hmm. Tell us what happened to you there, what you did.
I joined a group of 18 people from around the world. It actually wasn't students. We were students from the United States, but we ranged in age up to 60 years old, and there were lawyers and NGO workers, and a whole, 18 of us, mostly Asian countries. And we went into Burma as a group and handed out small leaflets, and all they said was, "We are your friends from around the world. We support your hopes for human rights and democracy. 8888, don't forget, don't give up." That's all the card said.
8888, the significance of that date?
That is the day, we always say that that's the day when the government, there was a pro-democracy uprising that culminated on 8888, and that's notes the massacre of the 10,000 pro-democracy students and other people.
So what happened to you? Where were you when you started to give out these pamphlets?
We were at strategic locations in Rangoon, spread out 3 by 3 by 3, and we handed out the leaflets for 10 minutes, and an hour later handed them out again, and that's when most of us were arrested.
How old were you at the time?
I was 21 at the time. Yeah.
And what happened?
We were arrested. Most people were arrested at the second location. Some groups were arrested at the airport. We were held for 3 days without talking to any officials, any representatives from the U.S. Embassy. And on the sixth day, we were whisked off to a trial. And in that trial, we were sentenced to 5 years in jail. It was about a nine-hour trial. We didn't understand anything that happened. It was mostly in Burmese. Sentenced to 5 years in jail, and that was the news that our family heard back in the States. That was the news that went out around the world. 20 minutes later, 30 minutes later, they came in and said, well, we'll deport you in the morning. And that's what happened to us. But this isn't it's not significant in terms of what happens to most of the people in Burma. Right now, the current crackdown on activists is something that has been escalating since 88. And there are still around 2,000 political prisoners in Burmese jails from this era and that have been arrested from 88 onwards that suffer just, I mean, we were treated very nicely. We weren't even put in insane prison where most political prisoners are kept in Burma. We were kept in guest houses and in offices of police officials. So we were treated very nicely. So it's nothing in comparison to what the people
and
of Burma experience.
Sandy Aung, what is happening right now to Aung San Suu Kyi?
She was staying. She was under house arrest. She wasn't allowed to see anyone, and diplomatic officials are denied access to her visit. And latest news is that there is a lock in front of her house, and all the riot police are in the station, so that nobody is allowed to see her. We are so concerned about her safety, and we were worried that she might have injured during the crackdown, during the raid like 2 days ago. This is a great concern for her safety, and nobody is allowed to see her yet.
So you're saying there's a lock on the outside of her
mm-hmm.
house?
Yeah.
So she's not allowed out?
No, she's not allowed out, and nobody's allowed in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
what was it like when you went to Burma in 1996?
Well, Burma is a state of fear. That everywhere, military is control everywhere in your life. Economically, security, in terms of security, everything have to report to the military. For example, if you want to go and sleep in one place, you have to report the township military committee. So it is a state of fear, and people live in the fear. People were deprived of the freedom of speech and deprived of knowledge, deprived of access to information.
Tell us about the protest on Friday at Nisha Anan. This is not only a protest around Burma, but with the world leaders gathering in New York.
There are several countries who will be at this gathering who don't represent the people of their country. They're simply figurehead leaders. And our idea is that during this summit, when everyone is concentrated here in New York for the UN gathering, there will be several demonstrations. And it starts off in the morning with a demonstration at the Burma mission to the UN, the consulate. And that'll start at 8:45 in the morning on Friday. And this is the kickoff of a whole day. That's also the kickoff of our campaign, the first time we publicly go out with demonstrations with the unseat message. And later that day, there'll also be one at the Peruvian embassy and just several others.
I understand Fujimori will also be in New York, the dictator of Peru. What do you think, Professor Patrick Bond, of the emphasis on the United Nations? Do you think in this millennium year that the UN is significant?
Well, yes, Amy, it's a very, very good question because, in fact, this week, progressive democratic forces around the world have their eyes on the UN, and I believe even today there's an international forum on globalization debate about whether there is any progressive role for the UN, given the global balance of forces, which are so adverse to progressive social change at the moment, especially in the sphere of economics. Now, the one position is that, like the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, IMF, the UN, with its flaws, with its lack of democracy, the strong role of the United States, can be reformed, and maybe the Security Council can be opened up. South Africa, as you may know, is desperately trying to gain a permanent seat on the Security Council, along with India. There's a debate about whether Africa should be represented by South Africa or Nigeria. And I think these are things that will be continued to play out in elite settings. I think amongst more progressive activists and intellectuals and those following the scene, because the UN has been such a parrot of the United States on security issues, and even the UN Development Program and UN Conference on Trade and Development have really succumbed to World Bank, Washington consensus type of economic logic. There is also a question about whether building a kind of global embryonic state through the United Nations makes sense. Certainly the progressive movement is moving very unequivocally to a position of shutting down the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and the IMF as its strategic orientation. Where that leads the UN is still, I think, up in the air, and partly this seminar that's continuing, not just today, but I think will continue in all sorts of ways. The pressure will really be on the UN to show itself as a force for progress. It hasn't done that recently.
And, of course, Burma is not the only country that has, as you mentioned, illegitimate leaders.
There are a lot of countries that don't represent the people. There will be a demonstration in Mexico in terms of the indigenous people. The New York Zapatista movement is actually doing that one. It's just whenever an international body gives recognition to undemocratic and illegitimate regimes, it does a whole disservice for any people of the world who are concerned about democracy.
Sandy Ng, being from Burma yourself, having returned to Burma in the last few years, you've watched this pro-democracy movement going on for many years, certainly in the case of Aung San Suu Kyi, for more than a decade. What do you realistically see, expect to happen in this year?
This year, I could not really say, but in the future, there will be a change for democracy. That's for sure, because we have built up momentum for democracy for the past 10 years. It hasn't been like that before 1988. Certainly for 1988, people are aware of the democratic change, and people have acted. People have voted in 1990 to show that they don't want to go back to a military dictatorship. They want democracy. However, they were cracked down by these 4 million soldiers. But still, I have a hope that there's a democratic forces have built up, and people inside Burma are aware of that fact that they have that people are supporting them, and they have to fight for it. So I can see there's going to be a change. But this year in particular, we are hoping that the UN will look at this matter in terms of whether they should continue with this illegitimate regime or they should really going to represent the people of Burma.
And what about U.S. companies like Unocal who are doing work there?
Well, U.S. has a partial sanction, on economic sanction, which ban only new investment. Therefore, Unocal is still can operate in Burma. But however, you know, in terms of Unocal, have to be held accountable for the human rights violation committed by their partner, which is the SPDC, the military regime, which is happening along the border, and this killing of the killing of villages and relocation of villages. Unocal should be held accountable for that.
On the issue of Unocal, Patrick Bond, which was, by the way, the U.S. having imposed sanctions against Burma, but working out a way with Unocal to grandfather Unocal in to allow them to continue to do business by saying companies that have previous business in Burma before the sanctions were imposed can continue. So it gives them a virtual monopoly since all the rest of the countries are sanctioned at this point, all the rest of the companies from doing anything.
And you probably recall 15 years ago, similar clever lobbyists for the corporations on Capitol Hill were able in the Anti-Apartheid Act, a comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act, similarly to find loopholes, so it wasn't too terribly painful. But that's where the dialectic of internal and external democratic struggle kicks in, because I think the more of the activism that the Burmese people can sense is happening, and the more, even if Massachusetts as a state is unable, because of the Supreme Court decision, to continue with selective purchasing, certainly the universities, as we get going into another semester of campus activism, and pension funds and churches and a variety of other investors can be very, very clearly sending signals to their fund managers to stay away from Unocal, to stay away from the World Bank and Citibank. There are a few targets out there at the moment that are the subject of these boycotts, and the South Africa case shows that they can make a terrific difference and in turn work hand-in-hand with the people on the ground to promote the kind of isolation that will then lead to pressure.
On that note, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Patrick Bond of Wits University in Johannesburg, South Africa, professor, associate professor of public policy. Nisha Anand with War Resisters League, Free Burma Coalition, and Sandy Ng, Burma Project Coordinator of the Asia-Pacific Center for Justice and Peace. I also want to say, as these world leaders come in, that Jafar Sadiq Hamzah, who is an Indonesian human rights lawyer, permanent resident here in the United States, went back to Aceh, his homeland, to work on the issue of human rights. Today is the month anniversary of his disappearance. And as we speak, autopsies are being done of five men whose bodies are found wrapped in barbed wire in Aceh. And we're going to see what the news is from that. I want to thank you all for being with us. Democracy Now! Produced by Jillian Aldrich, Jeremy Scahill, as well as Sid Rock. Thank you very much. Matthew Fincher, engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.